So I'm going to talk about some of the future architectures we're looking at for the low-level RF systems. We have one or two prototypes of this genre in the field. It's a pizza box approach, and we're looking to build a few more of these in the future. And I wanted to give a perspective of drilling down. I know we've been talking about a high-level architectures now for the last couple meetings, and this will give one example of what that high-level architecture would, at least what we would like it to incorporate. Not saying this is a standard for everything, but I think we have to accommodate something like this. So I'm going to go over these couple things here. I'm going to go over what our data acquisition functions are, the test system I'm using. I have one in my office I'm going to demo. And I'm going to go through the software and tools used to build these types of systems, and then go through my example DAQ system specifications, and then go through a short demo. So here's what our data acquisition functions are for low-level RF. First thing is a slow scalar readback of just general data going on inside the system. These are generally ACNET readbacks. Then we also use a low bandwidth continuous stream. It's a 20 kilohertz sample rate of continuous data without missing a sample that goes to our front end. It allows us to take long data samples for low frequency analysis, like, for example, our microphonics in a cavity, they're low frequency things, so we need long frequency analysis for that. The next type of DAQ is a moderate bandwidth. We usually use these in pulsed machines or a CW machine where we want to zoom in a section of maybe where the beam is happening. We like this type of resolution for RF signal analysis where we can look at beam loading and the effects of the beam on the RF. And then finally, I have a high bandwidth buffered sample system that runs at full ADC rates. We like to get about 1 million points. That allows us to look at frequency analysis of our RF signals coming in right at the ADC, what kind of RF signals we're sending out the DACs. This type of system, maybe we're thinking about event-driven data dumps, where this is in a circular buffer and some kind of event happens and we dump that data down to the control system. So here's my test system I'm working with. It's a Cyclone 5 with a ARM on the same silicon, and this is the low-level RF groups board. We have 16 ADCs running at 66 megahertz, 8 DACs at the same frequency. Like I said, ARM processor on FPGA silicon, and this just connects to the outside world through 1 gig Ethernet. And right now I'm just using a LabVIEW control interface. We also have one of our systems that Dennis connected to ACNET out at CMTS. The build environment for these types of systems, what I like to use is I use a Windows 10 host machine, and I build a Linux virtual machine. Currently I'm using the latest Ubuntu long-term system, and I'm running the Linux Qortis 18, which is the latest version of Qortis. And I have documents on how to put together the build system, which is quite of a, it could be a tricky thing to work through how to build all the environments you have to work in. So it's important to document your build environments as well. And what this also allows is if you're doing this all on a virtual machine, you can archive your whole project and save it for future use. So the build process for these types of systems, I'm just going to go a quick overview so you kind of get a gist of what's going on. We use the Altera platform designer. That's kind of what they call QSIS, where you build up your FPGA and ARM interfaces, so you build your bridges between the FPGA and the ARM CPU. There's build your DMA engines to transfer data from the FPGA directly into SDRAM on the ARM processor. Also, you could put in there your soft core processor, and that configures, in my system, it configures all the DMA engines and starts everything up in the boot process. The next thing usually I do is write Niles code for configuration. There's firmware programming. And I kind of bounce back. This is an exact flow. It's, you bounce back between all this stuff. And then there's the front-end software building system here. It's called SoCEDS. And then from there, you build your SD card, which is plugs right into the we call it a SOM, where the FPGA lives. So you build a Linux operating system, and you configure the boot and the preloader, and all the firmware goes onto that SD card. And I was in the process. I build my own kernels. I use the Yocto, which is Altera's recommendation for building kernels. There's really no one standard for that. Next, I configure the OS, get all the boot services done, the board initialization, and configure the time and all that kind of stuff. And finally, I put all this stuff in the Git repository, so the firmware, software, and service software goes into one repository.
Just out of curiosity, all the drivers for your DAX, all that stuff is Altera's already provided for the NEOS processor. I don't know how this
works. I mean, we use, we kind of balance where we can take IP that Altera builds. We use it if it makes sense. You know, in other cases, we have to build an interface. We built the interfaces for the ADCs and the DACs, but the NIOS is available from Altera, and there's PLLs and DMA engines and all that stuff that we use that Altera provides and has documents for.
The ADCs and DACs make
use
of IP.
Okay. Yeah.
So
I'm not going to go through all this, but this is kind of a specification, just a general thing I jotted down on what we want out of a DAQ system. So I just go through, okay, we want 40 waveforms at a microsecond sample in pulse mode, and we want 40 waveforms at 5 microsecond sample in CW mode. And just general things, what you need to do for this type of system. I won't go through all this stuff.
So this is general low-level RF tools you need.
It makes life easier when you're trying to work on a machine. I mean, having waveforms and RF signals in front of you while you're trying to configure everything is pretty important for us, especially when we're commissioning a system or debugging or things like that.
But for normal operation, which you want to do this, and if you do want to do it, who's going to use it and look at it doing it?
Well, I mean,
that's kind of an open question, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would, if I was sitting in front of the machine, I would want to see what the cavity signals look like in real time. I mean, like, to go down to Linux, you see the...
Let me rephrase it. Yeah. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Nobody's looking at the signals. Do we want this going out into the data acquisition system? I'm not for or against that. I'm just wondering, what we're going to do with it.
Well, our latest system doesn't dump all this stuff out. Right. It's requested. So if I'll show you in the LabVIEW interface.
So
if you click on, like, items that you want to see, that's when the data gets pulled out. It's stored in SD memory, but if you don't want it, it's not going anywhere.
I guess this is more of a general question for at least for tip 2.
Yeah.
What do we want to have as requested, and what do we want to have as nominally all the time?
I think there's certain things you want all the time. You want to see a cavity signal, magnitude and phase. You want to see maybe the forward power and reverse power. Those are usually no-brainers for us to send to ACNET, and they'll be available to see. Then there's other things like error, feedback errors and stuff that only we really care about when we're diagnosing things. So there's a list of probably 8 or 9 waveforms we usually send out intact and all the time. So, anyway.
So would this appear in a FRS, TRS at some point? The fact that you have these diagnostics that need to be developed and need man hours to implement?
Yes. So that should be fed, though, by request by above, saying we want to see this kind of data when we run the accelerator, and we want to see this kind of data when we tune up the accelerator. So at this point, we're defining it ourselves what we want.
Yeah.
How that feeds up to the accelerator physics has not been well defined yet.
Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of thing we want to see when we're out there.
I think that's how we're going to be doing it. We're going to say, what do we think we want to pass up?
Yeah.
The only reason I bring it up is because you start multiplying these numbers together and you're in a single crate, the bandwidth starts really popping up.
Yeah. Like, for example, this system, if you got all 40, if you say, I want all 40 waveforms right now, you know, it ends up being like 128 megabits per second. It's not that much.
From one crate,
but once you start adding them up. But if you just, if it's not, nobody's requesting it, nothing's being sent, so.
Okay, to answer your question, I think we're going to have to maybe answer this ourselves, or propose it, and if it works, then people will say fine. If it doesn't work, then we'll have to back off.
Well, yeah, I think it's very valid to be a bottom-up push for it, to say, this is what we need in order to commission the machine, and as an engineer, I
think
that's cool.
Yeah, it kind of has to go ping pong back and forth. Right. So you know, if we say, well, I want a gigabit out of every front end, it's going to come back down and say no. So, but anyway, so here's what kind of the system I came up with. It's this is the FPGA portion of the DAQ system. And I have some code here that takes in 40 streams and serializes the data into what Altera calls their streaming interface. It's over the Avalon bridge. So this is running alongside this other one, which does full speed interface. So I can multiply 16 waveforms. I choose and pipe them into another interface. And these are blocks that sit in the QSIS platform designer. So these interfaces go into these DMA engines, which is Altera IP. And you configure them with the NIOS CPU here. So this gets all configured. And then you have to go over some clock crossing bridges to get into the ARM DDR3. And that's on a AXI bus. So this is a general interface. So if you look at what's going on here, I'm just taking all these points and then I'm packing them into a 64-bit bus. And then depending on the sample rate, I'll just pad the spaces in between and then pipe that data out. And this didn't come out so well, but this is the overall system. So here's, you can see the DAQ system here. And then this block here is the QSIS section where to interface to the outside world, really. So the NIOS is here, all your DMAs, the ARM CPU is here. And so you can see the data path is a purple line. It goes here to SD-RAM and then out Ethernet. And so the ARM CPU controls when this data gets buffered out. On the input to the FPGA, you have DACs and ADCs. So you got your 16 ADCs here and your 8 DACs here. So we bring them in through this receiver, and then your controller or whatever you want to do with the data lives here, and then they come out if they need to out DACs here. And then there's our clock configurations. So really, this system runs on one clock for the signal chain, which is about 66 megahertz, and then you have to go through another clock domain to get into the ARM CPU, and you can do those with those clock crossing bridges.
And just remind myself, right? I haven't done this for a while, but the NEOS 2, right, runs its own micro C OS 2 or something like that, and your ARM runs on Linux.
I'm not running an operating system, it's just bare metal code. It's
okay,
just running
so
the C.
Pedal to the metal, that's it.
Yeah.
So And NEOS 2 just pokes everything directly into registers or whatever.
It's C code, though.
Yeah.
It's not doing much. It's just setting up everything
like
to start.
Yeah.
It's less than that, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just configuring the DMAs,
yeah,
so when you boot up, everything gets set and ready to go, and then the ARM fires and starts things from. So this is what that looks like in actual firmware. So this is the NIOS block. Here's the serial data that's converted, all these 40 waveforms. Here's a high-speed interface. Here's some registers that come from the NIOS. These are registers from the ARM. Here's my ADCs, my DAC, and some controller. These are some receivers I'm working on. And then my PLLs that are for the clock. A lot of this stuff is self-generated. When you build the HPS, it sets up these pins to interface to the outside world. So I'll just go through what we do in our LabVIEW control interface. So I have two displays with six channels of waveforms each. Each waveform is a 1K points. And it's kind of like it's supposed to be like an oscilloscope. So you pick your channels and you can change the time base and offset your trigger and things like that. You could also go into scalar mode on the displays. There's control panels to write to registers. There's diagnostic panels to look at your timings and your versioning of your software. And then there's also the full speed waveform capture, so you can do FFT analysis. This is kind of what it looks like here. You have your two main displays, and these are, right now, this is showing like a CW mode, so it shows the waveform. This is a 20 kilohertz sample rate. If you looked at it over time and just kept building it up, it wouldn't miss a beat here, so you get those long data samples. Here's the control panel, so you make adjustments to feedback gain and control parameters there. And here's some scalar data you could read over on the side that gives you like an averaged magnitude or phase of the cavity and things of that nature. And then control interface here, so turn your feedback on or off for the RF enable and things like that. So this is what kind of the high speed data capture looks like. You click the button and you select which waveforms you want, and it gives you a nice FFT of the data, and then you could look at it in the time domain as well. This is kind of a diagnostic panel. This kind of gives you lets you look into what the front end is doing, so the timing of your looping DAQ system, make sure that you're able to push the data out fast enough and you're not running into bottlenecks there. Then down here you have like firmware versions, software versions, your sample rates, and there's some debugging tools here you can turn on and off. That comes in handy. So I'll just go through a quick demonstration here, and this is the circuit I'm looking at. So I have if you look at here, I have an NCO running at 5 megahertz in the firmware, and I pipe it out the one of the DACs. And these blue lines are where I'm taking data taps. So these go into the DAQ system. And then I loop this back to one of the ADCs, and then so I could analyze the frequency of the input here. I have a gain block, and then I do an IQ sampling, and down convert. So this is now at baseband, and I could look at my frequency spectrum here, and then some filtering and chordic magnitude and phase detector here. So I'm able to look at, in the baseband, the amplitude and phase. That's it for my... Oh, what happened?
You got to
okay.
Your slides.
Okay, so that's that. I'll just go through a quick demo. This is running in my office right now. So I was saying that you have the two displays, and what you can do is like select from any one of those 40 waveforms and display them on your display here. And here you could select your time base. So right now it's sampling at 5 microseconds. I could get a longer data sample, go to 15 or something like that, and get a longer sample set. It doesn't really fit. It's hard to show you everything, but down here is your control panels. So here's the main control panel. You could go to CW or pulse mode, turn your RF and feedback on. If we want to take a look at what this system can do. Oh, there we go. It's hard to do a live demo. The one thing, the first point in that chain was the gain. So like I'm able to adjust the gain here. So you see the gain pop up, and you can adjust the phase as well. But the more interesting thing to look at is your full speed analysis here. This allows you to really understand what your data looks like in the frequency domain. So if I select the signal right at the ADC, and then I look at it, let's say the I component at baseband. Oops. Capture the data. So you can see it's a big buffer. So right now I have 10 of 5,000 point packets. So these are 50,000 point SFTs. I can make them bigger. It just keeps adding the buffer data to the packets as it goes. But you can see I had the 5 megahertz NCO when I put it in the put it back into the ADC, you end up with a 5 megahertz, and then now you see, oh, I got some signal here at FS over 2 minus 5. So that shows up when you do something like this. And then if you look at the down converted signal, it's brutal. Now you see, I down-converted the 5 megahertz to baseband, but you also see the omega times 2 signal here, and then you see the image of these things is here. So now you get an idea, okay, now what kind of filter do I have to build to knock this stuff out? And I could keep going, but it's really difficult to work in this environment here. But I think you kind of get the gist of what I'm looking at here. So, look at...
The SFT doesn't look live, right? Is it live or it's not live?
No, it's not live. It's taking really, it's only less than a millisecond of data. So it's zipping
it. Until you hit the button to ask.
Yeah, then it starts on, it fills up the buffer instantaneously, and then it just starts unloading that buffer. It's too big to send at once. But it's buffered data. So if you look at what this thing looks like after the filter, and you get something like that. So now you can really analyze your system with these types of DAQ systems and really understand what kind of signals you're looking at. And that's about it for now.
Well, that looks good.
So this is just
gives me a much better idea. I mean, the things when I'm thinking about a DAQ system, I'm just thinking about instrumentation, right?
Yeah.
I'm not this impressed upon me. You guys have got your own set of requirements.
Yeah. It's more tools to understand.
And it interesting. How make sure we can pay for them, make sure that we can provide people to support them. How long did you spend learning these things? You probably had to multiplex through many things over the years, but
I went from
end to end to do what you just did up there. How long did you spend?
Well, this was a new type of system back in 2013. They just came out with these. Yeah, they came out with these SOCs back in 2013. And I spent 6 months to a year getting
learning
a grip
QSYS,
on how
to,
these.
How to
yeah,
use the HLS.
Yeah.
And
the QSYS is new. Was new. The building kernels was new. Working in a Linux. I mean, it's just a general Linux environment, so I had some experience with it, but just the whole build environment was a little bit new. It took about a year.
And over the years, you guys developed your LabVIEW diagnostics for different projects.
We had LabVIEW for the last 10, 15 years.
Are you using Backdoor to get to LabVIEW, or what?
No, I wrote a protocol for it.
So you got your own...
Yeah, it's pretty basic. All it does is each parameter has a name, and then in LabVIEW you can search by name, and then when it flags you found the name in the string, it just has data following.
You're also serving data out to ACNet.
Right. Yeah, they're two separate paths.
Separate,
yeah, so the front end runs a thread for LabVIEW, and I think there's something similar, some kind of thread
so
that runs for ACNet.
What in all this, is it like a MOOC?
No, it's one of our Erlang front ends.
Okay.
It just talks over Ethernet to this box.
So you have a polling scheme, right? That just kind of looks at registers.
So what is it?
Use communication.
I mean, can you do anything?
UDP?
Fast time plots or as far as, or is it?
Yeah, what we do... Through that, we can do like individual waveforms, you know, pick any of those waveforms and look at those, or you know, the individual gain. The systems have like 200 register settings, individual registers that we deal with.
But the rates are much slower. These are, I think, only 10 kilohertz sampling. The rates are what ACNet, Central ACNet. That data rate, maybe not even displayed or not data at that rate. It's the CW stuff, is all that is going
on. Yeah.
Not the fast rate.
I think we're going to have to get to
developing the ACNet interface into the ARM processor, essentially.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we don't have as
so
good of an app, we don't have as good of a graphical user interface as what you can get with LabVIEW there.
One thing we have to be careful is keep an eye on what one control system does and make sure it updates all the other control systems attached to it. Because in the back door, we had an issue with somebody's changing stuff on ACNet. We didn't see it on a LabVIEW interface. We had a coach press a button and update.
Two pass. That's the
So, so the Erlang front end, it just takes out data. You're not running any process client server processes on his board.
Yeah, I think this one.
You set up a loop to deliver data at a rate, or
for ACNet, it's the data structure is kind of set in stone. You know, it's like you have readings and settings, and then you have a specified set of waveforms, so that just gets through the pipe for ACNet. For LabVIEW, you start using up bandwidth if you start selecting too many things. So, so we just send what's requested. It's a different.
I'd like to set scheme. LabVIEW aside. I think it's interesting, but just think about what you know. So I want to start thinking about how this system becomes very much like other systems.
So this, I go off and get another FPGA or something that runs the same ARM processor, this can just get dumped in.
We're talking about, this is running on a Cyclone 5 and Philips getting a Aria 10, and it should, the architecture should just transfer,
the same
right?
ARM processor, yeah. All that stuff.
That's what it is.
Yeah. We might have to do some IP updates.
I mean,
the
interface is written in C code for the ARM processor and C code for Erlang code, whatever, for the Erlang front end, but it's C code that we have on the level system. It's C code that we write and we have control over, that, you know, we can update or whatever, we change registers.
Well, then is there, most of us were all using Altera, is Xilinx or something, do they have the same ARM processor?
Exactly, you should be able to use it for the ARM processor on the Xilinx also. It's the exact same ARM processor.
Yeah.
It's a good thing about
the tools are the trick, though.
That's
it took.
I'm not familiar with what the ARM base is. This sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, I think after you get...
Once we get the base set up...
The firmware, once you get to the ARM, it's all the same. A lot of the... Well, when I was trying to figure out how to do this, I was reading Xilinx data sheets more than I was Altera's, because they were a little further along in the ARM side of things. But yeah, it should just translate. Except for the build tools. You know, it takes months to learn how to use Altera's stuff. It's going to take months to learn how to use Xilinx stuff. If you got the time.
Okay.
So, well, that's it. And I have this pretty well documented. I'll put it up on DocDB. It goes through how to put together all your build tools, how to create a basic system. And I'm even trying to get to the point where I'm documenting this whole system.
Can you send me the .db number for?
It's not there yet.
Well, I mean, yeah, when you get it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Dennis, you mentioned that, you know, the big advantage of LabVIEW had all the GUI and all the graphical displays.
It's a lot prettier.
Is the upgrade for the modernization of the control system, are you guys going to get much more tools like that?
Can you replace LabVIEW?
And we're just going to give it LabVIEW and do this with a console app or some other app?
Well, I think.
Make it more.
You know, the goal would always be to improve what we have in ACNET native stuff, but we don't have the resources to redo LabVIEW.
Yeah.
Synaptic, though. I mean, the Synaptic pages are almost there. You know. Yeah.
But I guess before we leave this, I guess I wanted to point out some things. So, in Ed's system, there is an ARM processor in there. We don't have our Erlang front end running on their embedded processor. We could, and actually, you know, I was working with Josh to do that a little bit, you know, a few years ago, and we stopped that effort just because of it becoming too much of a hassle. Because I think mostly because of where Josh was in the development of Linux at that point.
Yeah.
He was just having to rebuild his kernel all the time. Every time you did that, you had to go back and rebuild it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll take Erlang out to a higher level on a network machine, you know, network PC somewhere, and we'll talk this protocol between the Erlang front end PC and the ARM embedded system.
Okay.
This kind of goes to discussions I was having with Craig earlier this morning. You know, where do the things. What level does the different processes occur at? And so there, you know, we could, you know, move the Erlang stuff so it's talking ACNET out of the Ethernet interface to this low-level box, this Ethernet. But we decided to leave the Erlang stuff up at a higher level or a separate level for this system.
Yeah. I could see it running its own thread.
Yeah,
pretty much. I just have a thread running like a LabVIEW thread that does the protocol. It sits there and waits for commands, and when the DAQ is ready, it pipes it out.
It's one of the CLX central click machines that run the control system.
So the only disadvantage of that is you have to have one of those. For each guy, if you wanted to manage a full hand,
it's a single point failure.
Yeah. It's
you can run access in the RMS.
It's
just a choice.
Like I said, there were like too many different things going on at the time that we got this one going. And it's like, all right, we'll just split it. It'll make both our lives easier.
So Dennis, can you give us a presentation one of these days on what was done there? Because after Josh left, like, he didn't document anything, so we can't figure out what he did on the ARM side. So at least what knowledge you have of that portion of the...
Well, I know how the thread Ed's talking about, I know how that works.
Okay.
But then beyond that, I don't know.
Yeah, I did most of the work up to protocol compiler. And that's where
I close my eyes. I can talk about that, the protocol compiler.
Yeah, maybe that's something to review for us.
I can smaller group.
So that bridge, you know, we need to understand.
I can definitely better the group about that.
Okay. Well, we'll put that in an agenda, so that we can all figure out what you guys are just talking about. So I have no idea. Let's see. I shared. All right, so we have a very short time, 7 minutes. So maybe I'll introduce what I'd like to talk about. We can get some. Maybe I can get some sense whether you guys want to talk about it in the way I thought to talk about it, or you want to talk about it in a different way. We'll go ahead. Let's see. How do I get this thing to move? Okay, so I was considering combinations. This is back up at a system level, where we're not considering too many details, but we are considering the architectures that we've talked about, and you'll probably have in mind certain hardware associated with these things. I don't know if we're all thinking about the same hardware yet or not, and there'll be classes of hardware that works better for one in one context than the other, that's fine. It may be when it comes down to it, for us all to do our best in the different contexts, we'll need different things. But if we can avoid having lots of different kinds of front ends, then that would be of benefit. I mean, if we could send our data on a standard protocol to a standard box that receives data in that protocol, then there could be a standard front end in some cases that can be a very just global type of unit. Is kind of one ideal, but then we see how that falls apart when you get into the details, or how you might be able to stitch it back up. So let me just go over the simple things. So out of PIP 2, for the sake of MPS, I still have MPS in mind and instrumentation. So we could split things at the analog box, and in some cases that might be the best thing to do. We can make quick decisions on scrapers and those kind of things. The pros that I came up with for this were that there's a minimum MPS instrumentation overlap. So the instrumentation equipment doesn't have an MPS data path through it, except for the detector and the analog bit. And this would be the lowest latency to get a decision. You're not going over a link, so that reduces some of the latency. The cons I came up with were you can only make MPS decisions with local measurements. You don't want to send these analog signals up and down the length of the LINAC if you're trying to make decisions, analog or number decisions, like taking the differential current at each end of the detector. But it could work for certain situations. But now you have the duplication of of complex signal processing. If the thing you're going to measure, the analog signal you're going to measure, needs a lot of lookup tables or special conditions, filtering, if we're continuously trying to improve the signal to noise on these certain signals, you'd only want to do it in one place as opposed to doing it in operations and the MPS system. So that's a consideration. And this is just basically the same thing except for sending a status out. The MPS, it sends data. It has its own digitizer and transmitter to send data to a receiver box. So we have digitizers with an FPGA, what I called an FPGA ACNET front end, but I guess it's not an ACNET front end, it's a Erlang front end, or it's an Ethernet. If you break it down to the basics, maybe it's just an Ethernet and you decide how you send the data. It's just another path to send data to a receiver that then connects that data to ACNET as a front end. Connects it to ACNET. Pros. Local microprocessor support. You got all this microprocessor support for all of the things that we saw low-level RF needs to do. So having this, it looks pretty essential for the sort of things that low-level RF is doing. It's probably not essential for some of the instrumentation things that we do, or the instrumentation has other ways to do it. I thought it would have, now, so this Ethernet that comes from a box like this, it has to go to another front end processor of some kind. Is that right, Dennis?
Right, yeah, so that's what.
Yeah, we were just talking about. Okay, so you could include high speed links on this to send to what I would say would be like waveform data collection or machine learning, but the rule that we have so far about mixing MPS with things that have this much processing and this much complexity that you would want to play with or change, you want to avoid having a MPS data path through this.
I think we had bandwidth issues, right? CMTS.
Yeah, some of that was real issues and some of that was how we were transmitting the data.
Okay. Is there, I think at some point we might have some bandwidth limitations on each front end.
Okay.
Going out.
All right, so I'll just show these last two slides in this vein and then you guys can stay and talk or go. So here's the first part of an analog front end. With when you digitize it, it's all sent out on fiber links. Maybe you have a fiber link receiver. I have this bias toward simple protocols on serial links. I believe the simple protocols would lend themselves to electronics that scales in complexity. So you could put small, simple things, as long as they could be connected to some kind of fiber transmitter. I don't know if the fiber transmitters need a minimum clock rate, but you could send these out, data out with the same protocol. It would just be slower, or it could send it out with faster clock rates.
And there's a minimum clock rates for all these transceivers. I think it's in the 1 gigabit per second.
Okay. All right. Well, I think a lot of the little boards that are coming out now, they'll do that, I suppose. So this is something that someone could walk, as long as you could do the protocol, you could walk up with your own board. Otherwise, we want to share intellectual property on putting together between low-level RF and instrumentation and some of the other systems to help us solve problems. All right, so we can explore these things in a little more. I'd like to present what the front ends look like. When we were talking to Dennis this morning,
if there's a way to create a more standard front end. I mean, the evolution of instrumentation and controls has been, we all started off sending analog signals to MADCs. And then the processing in the 90s got better. It's like, oh, I could do something with this. I could do a digital down conversion. I can do more complex gating and averaging if I do the digitizing myself. And then I have to send the data. So I have to send the data. I have to send it to my own processor and my own front end. And then you are free to distribute the functions, which it'd be good to know specifically what our functions are, between FPGA boards and front ends, and then the functions that are taken care of by the control system, and then the functions that are taken care of by the consoles and the applications, and have a look at the way those functions are distributed. And then if we start with something new, maybe we can refresh the way we do things and put things, put the functions in places where it allows for more commonality and less variety. So a box that just receives data and stores it in a big memory, then can be accessed by a front end. I can imagine sending, somebody could tell me if I'm wrong, but creating like toroid data that just goes to a generic receiver memory. And it could be the same box that receives temperatures or other data from other systems. I mean, it doesn't have to be a specific instrumentation front end. We can send toroid data to a generic front end, perhaps. Of course, with large systems like BPMs and BLMs, well, we probably need crates. And then we want to look into what kind of crate. And that same crate that we put our BLMs and BPM equipment in, it would probably be the same crate that this receiver memory box would use too. So we're all using the same crate. Okay, I'll let you guys go.
So Craig, I would just add one more combination there, which would be a crate with a backplane.
I was rushing to get my diagrams in here today. That's definitely it. Yeah, for the BPMs, the BLMs, I think we have to have crates with backplanes and our own front ends, because the complexity of chopping up BLM and BPM data is very specific. We wouldn't want to stick that on controls. Or if they did, you know, they'd need a special person to do it all the time. I'm done. Thanks for coming. Yeah, send me agendas. You guys want to talk about things, you want to present things. It's good to share the information.
Denise is putting together for PIP2 a basis of estimate for big data storage and archiving and transmitting and what all for that.
Yeah,
it's being thought about.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of just in a whole new. Well, I mean, I got plenty of stuff to do before I get to that layer, right? You know, I'm still doing some operations on my portal to get the last
day. Analog cars all be different, but the digitizing cars.
She'd be looking for data rates.
Yeah, she's talking.
I'm just sending an email out. I'm going to make a comment, but I'll send out some to you, Randy.
I mean, it's more get done with the.
I mean, really, we're not generating much. We just give the eight or nine waveforms.
So maybe we jump one HLO board,
like 1 megabit.
We do the piggyback board with FPGA.
Where everything is,
continuously forever.
Yeah, I mean,
because they don't understand why everything's so expensive.
I don't know who wants to
see that. M&S doesn't save you.
Well, see, that's the question.
Well, if you have multiple designs, it saves you.
What's the requirement?
That's the logic.
So how? So she has to come up with a cost estimate. It's like, okay, is this like a terabyte a day, or is this
terabyte
like a month?
Get rid of how many terabytes you hold on to it, and when it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah. I mean, it makes more sense to have like a circular buffer, and then
Grabbed the last hours with the data and closed it and store that.
That's all I mean.
More distributed
stream.
Right.
They have
strong
retention policies that are like a week long.
Yeah.
You find out how much a week's worth of your data costs and you buy X number of machines.
Right.
And when it's gone,
try
it's
to
gone.
Come up with
yeah.
a single
it falls off
digitizing paperwork.
Well, when I first was doing this, I was looking
that
at, well,
the needs of all
somebody was saying, well, we need a megahertz sample rate, and
so
we want to
need
store
the specs for
data.
Those other things.
Right.
We'll need,
like,
somebody will have to give us the spec for those other things to be able to make the decision.
Everything is outside of our control. Because what we could, so what we can do is at least evaluate.
What are you going to do?
So the first point is, is it even feasible?
Yeah, I mean, you could
and
have a single
buffer
that gets maybe
20
minutes
or
and then
not noisy. Come up with obviously high speed, like we can use a BPM 250 megahertz type digitizer 16
right.
bits
okay, so
for everything, and we just use FPGA to decimate down.
There's
got to
be a need for that.
We don't need 250 megahertz for the tool.
I've had never had a user.
But you
go
back
and
look
at
it down.
It's
just
RF
where I put it to you and then
PM. 10
general,
seconds.
General quote specification for a board to come one design, because that would help. I did my value engineering. I talked about that.
But having the circular buffer there for a postmortem, you know.
But it could cut
out. Yeah, that's always
the thing you want.
Not
just hardware, but software. You know, each one of the boards are slightly different.
It doesn't have to be a stream.
I mean, it just has to be there.
So I was going to send you a mention piece, but
it's like I do that high speed.
Maybe we can get together. Don't question it.
So
it
fills
what's
up.
What's the information
you know,
we need to 100 know,
megabytes and
to
yeah.
know
seconds,
that we can
but,
make
but
a digitizer
just,
that's
right.
We have to find the
packet.
It's
going to
be specific instances of systems that are going
to
use that digitizer.
So we have that.
Yeah,
some of that
just
in order to go, in order
right.
to put it in the BOE and in order to document it for the project, we'll have to say this
right.
board's going to be used for this, this, this,
right.
and this.
Anyway,
right. So at the moment, we didn't do that.
Okay.
But we can change the BOE.
You know how much the structure of Brian's structure would change if you brought all that money that necessary, whatever money was necessary, you'd imagine it's going to be less in some.
Right, that's all motivation.
But it's completely distributed in this way, and then when you do that, it's going to be distributed in this way, and that's going to change the project documentation. And
that,
they have
that
to
is
be,
correct, and that's an issue that we'll have to deal with, but we don't want to deal with right now.
Yeah,
because,
I know, they don't
we don't have
that,
a generic
right?
engineering one.
If we show
yeah,
a cost,
each individual. So what? I don't.
If we show a cost less, I mean, we're doing.
It's changeable right now.
Value engineering. It's changeable right now, but is it changeable after July?
Probably. I think up until about CD2. It just we
when
still would have to.
When is CD2? I thought it was like June.
Well,
that's not true.
No, that's July. But that's the meeting. I mean, that's the president.
Yeah, that's
so
what I was saying.
The,
after July,
that's
after
the,
CD2
review. The of course, we'd want to freeze it by July. So we have a little bit of time, but I mean, the idea was a few year meetings with this, and then can we come up with something just from a cost point of view? We don't have to go through the design. We have to say something and say, yes, we'll put this in the BOEs, and we'll make it so that we're going to have one design, and maybe we'll, you know, make it a little, but without, we need some documentation to back it up in terms of cost.
Yeah, because it won't be an instrumentation. It won't be a BPM. Right now, it's what we have is a BOE for BPMs.
Yeah,
they won't
have to figure
they
out.
They won't have a BOE for digitizers. The interfaces will all change, and they'll have
so
to.
So I would suggest what we did is we would just put it under whatever instrument needs it first, and have it under that, even though it'll be used everywhere. And just we'll just say digitizer comes from Beam Current, WPS or BPM, whichever one we decide to put it under.
Or
maybe to alleviate this. Major change.
Yeah. So
maybe
if
you're right.
We use the same designs. Okay. So we design it with other people in mind, but we don't say that. We design it for the BPM. You know, when we record it and log it. Okay. The progress of the BPM digitizer is here, 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 and here. And now when they run these other projects, the digitizer for the RF readback of something. Is here. Oh, we've already got a digitizer design. We've skipped that. You make the change request just reflecting the fact that you skipped it and you didn't spend the money. And then, so you make these incremental, wherever you have to patch in a change request, that's where
that'll be, that's the implementation hub. The first question is, is it even doable from a technical point of view? And if we say, yeah, it is, then we'll work out the BOE stuff with Brian, and we'll get with the Blue Cell, and we'll figure out some way to make it work. My guess, the easiest thing is just to put it under one device, put it under BPM.
Do you know?
BPM, that's all, and everybody else just take it out.
Well, I mean, low-level RF's not going to use our digitizer.
No.
What other things do they have to digitize?
So, Brian, it wasn't clear, because what's Phil's board? How fast was it? I thought it was pretty fast.
It was 66 megahertz. Or Phil Boards actually has a high-speed digitizer?
The one that they got from, that they're working with that French company for the piggyback. Well, that's a good question. Whether anybody else could use it. So for us, the only thing that drives us to high-speed is the BPM system. Everything else doesn't need, we don't need high digitizing rates for the beam current. We don't need it for BLM. We don't need it, I mean, for BPM we do, but for anything else, it's low noise what we want. We want low noise and stable systems. I mean, everything, all the other pickups are slow, right? They're all at the megahertz level or slower, so you don't need 250 megahertz digitizers for something that's a bandwidth of only, you know, hundreds of kilohertz. But if it saves you money, and assume the board prices aren't much different, you build the one board, you build the highest end board, and you just average it, decimate down to a lower bandwidth for the other systems.
Well, if the digitizer and the clock rate for the digitizer, I mean, if you have a board, you think about its functions. You have the digitizing, maybe a clock distribution system that has certain specs that are different at a high clock than a low clock. You have an FPGA. You have the micro TCA interface, and maybe a fiber interface. So all the digitizers will have all the same components, except for maybe they could have a cheaper FPGA, if you want to save cost there, and a slower DAC.
So the
or they just put on a slower DAC, leave the high speed.
So it isn't the it
design.
Isn't it isn't.
And so the design only changes that in that little.
But that's
section.
Not the cost saving. The cost saving is not doing another design because the people are the most expensive part.
Right. So I mean, you're not doing that. You're designing everything, and the only part of that everything you change is this circuit here, which takes less time than laying out a whole another FPGA.
If that's possible, if it's possible to pop in, you know, with minimal changes to the board for one. The other thing it also allows for is support. Now you end up having, you know, you have to have different boards for all the different systems. You have one board that spares for everybody. You have one set of boards you're designing. So the motivation was to reduce FTE cost. It wasn't to reduce M&S cost, because the M&S cost isn't big compared to. So right now we have a design effort. We have multiple design efforts for every system as its own board. In reality, we're not going to probably do that. So the question is, how many boards, minimum boards do we need? Maybe we do what you say. Maybe it's a small changes here, minimize the design. I'm mostly worried about software. I mean, every time you change parts, it affects drivers and communication, and that's a lot of that's a lot of John's time.
The firmware.
Else we get, yeah.
Well, the firmware. Yeah. We should be at. Well, if
this is not a, this is a problem we've had for forever.
Drivers shouldn't have to change that much. I have to talk. I need to talk to John about. Lexi was trying to tell me about this, and I'm imagining why are we having to write drivers every time we change anything?
Because the hardware, the manufacturer people have.
It's like it
hardware.
Should just be a memory map. It's just it's.
Yes, but it's never that easy. This is a problem. As long as I've been any kind of technical field dealing with digital systems. Drivers are always notoriously a pain in the ass to write your own. As much if you can get a vendor to supply one, that's great. But for a lot of stuff we do, we don't have.
Well, that. This my simple view of a front end code is you have addresses between here and here. That's the VME crate.
Yeah.
And you figure out, okay, the first board takes up this memory to here, this memory to here, this memory to here. The VXI had a resource manager that automatically built that up for you, and you just have addresses, and your code has pointers to buffers.
I can't answer specifics, but I think that's the.
But that seems too
zero order view, which is never the case.
Yeah.
All I know is, as long as I've worked, for 30 years, as long as I've worked anywhere and stuff, whenever we had to deal with drivers, those were always the most big,
that's it. I never called it a driver. And Boost, when I did the little things I did in Booster, I never called it a driver. It was just, It was just a pointer to in memory, VME memory.
And John would be better answering this than I would. You know, so the idea would be, because what, so from most of the stuff I worked with, it wasn't stuff we designed. It was a vendor supplying us hardware, and we had to talk to their hardware through a driver. We, for example, VxWorks, what ended up happening is people make drivers, they make drivers for Windows, right? But we're not using Windows, we're using VxWorks, so we have to write our own. And then you got to write your own, but you're dealing with their hardware, and they don't always, you know. So that, so maybe my experience is different because working with, if we design our own, it's different. And John would give a better answer, but the point would be is that most of our cost is in a lot of electronics and software design for many, many cards. If we can reduce that, that would save us. I don't think we're going to save a lot on M&S. If you buy the card, if you build the card, I think the parts and the card costs are not going to change a lot, maybe, you know, 30-40%, but not factors of three. You know, that's my just what on my rough guess.
Well, for a $3,000 board might be $300 less,
right? So you're at the 10-20% level. Yeah. But if you look at our, if you look at the right now, the costing for the project, M&S is only like 25% of all the costs of
right,
people.
Right.
So, hey, we can't. You still need people to do stuff. You can't.
So, like you said, it's the design time that costs us so much.
Yeah, and but the thing what Lee and them aren't realizing is we're still going to have unique analog boards for each. You know, a VLM analog board is totally different than a beam current, totally different than a VPM. So the analog boards are all going to be different.
Yeah.
Those will have to all be designed. Not very little software, if any, for that. You know, the pickups on the mean line is going to be all unique designs because there's just not enough space to fit everything in. And so about the only place we can get away with this is probably the digital electronics and the software. But the signal processing will be different for all the systems have their own unique system for signal processing.
So the firmware. There's going to be firmware and the digitizer, that's a lot of time.
Maybe get away with, like I say, the drivers are talking different pieces, and all the ACMAN interfaces can be the same. So I can't speak right now. I'm having a hard time convincing Lee and Edward that the numbers that we came up with for what we said we would do are not that far off. Now, the question is, they want us to go out and, you know, big borrow and steal stuff from everybody. Maybe we can, but that's their thing. Maybe, no.
I bet they're like, why don't we put in VME crates?
No, they weren't quite that low. They did understand that argument. They didn't understand about the VMEs old. But for example, why don't we just build the same thing in effort to build it? Why don't we just take their digitizer and use it for us? Skip the design and we'll just take all their software and hardware and we'll use it.
Skip the design.
Maybe we can. I don't know.
Well, their board's already obsolete. We have the electronics obsolescence problem. You know, that's
you know about their, I don't know anything about what they build. Micro TCA or
by the time PIP2 gets here, it'll be obsolete.
Well, and that's another problem, because they
built their stuff 5 years ago, right?
I don't know. Effort. A while ago. Well, they're in the process of coming up right now, but I think you're right. I don't know if it was 5 years ago, but it was...
You just have to ask EFRIB if they were going to put a system, the PIP2, at their facility, would they use the stuff that they have now?
That's another thing, is now it's a kind of crapshoot for support for the future. You know, we bought these crates that Nathan wanted to buy, that we bought a number of them, the VXS crates, which now the industry is given, no one's interested in.
Yeah.
So any kind of future use of those is pretty much impossible. We can't get a crate controller. The crates themselves are expensive and they're going away. But back, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago when we bought these crates, that was a big hot thing. So who knows? So you kind of have to look at industry and say, who's... get a crystal ball and try to guess what's going to be around in 5 years, 6 years. So I got to go finish. I finished Paul's slides. Okay, we'll see if he wants more, and then I have to finish working. I got to get ready for the next start.
I like to see the prices of things. I still, you know, everybody likes their pet, their own ideas.
Yeah.
But the point to point, the only thing you're standardizing on is the transceiver. Everything else is very flexible. I mean, a box that receives fiber data and processes it, that could change, you know, all the time, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
those boxes, there's always going to be boxes like that. And yeah.
And it's already 3:30 on
that. If you could find a, if you could find it, and all you're relying on being persistent is the fiber driver receiver, and people are standardizing on those pretty hard, even more than the crates. You know, if you have a crate, well, now you're gonna have to be able to buy a processor for that crate in 10 years.
Well, if you do it, if you do pizza box and you don't.
So yeah, you buy a pizza box. So pizza boxes or the point to point, you know, you got your own, you roll your own backplane in a sense.
The only thing is, I do like the processor down as close as you can to the detector at some level to some signal processing that doesn't make the data rate. We just end up putting out the raw data rate, then I'm a little concerned that we...
you don't have to put out the raw data rate.
You put out
whatever number that makes sense.
The only thing that's really bad for us is the BPM system. Everything else is not a high bandwidth. But the BPM system is the one that's not.
You know, the thing that surprised me in the booster, I don't know if it's going to be in this case, they created, it was like 2006, they had to make a new beam loss monitor system for the Tevatron, and Stephen Portis took that over and put together a group, and me and Randy and people from PPD and Alan Bombau and those folks, that they designed a new BLM system. It's a whole system. It's like five different kinds of boards. It was a digitizer, an integrator digitizer board that was read out over VME. There was a board matrix card, there was a timing card, there was Brian Fellin's high voltage card, and then there was another card that had a Z80 processor that used the P2 bus to manage all these data between the cards.
Right. All this legacy stuff.
So I thought, oh, this is all crazy. When I go to the booster, all I need is the integrator digitizer board, we read it out with a processor, we're done. I thought that was going to be so easy. But then I went to Bob Goodwin, and I showed him the board, and I said, yeah, the data is 32 bits. Just read that out. That's how we get our dynamic range. And he just was going to, I don't know, he's going to hit me or something. Because he said, no, you can't do that, you know, because everything in our system is 16 bits. We don't do 32 bits.
That's another issue.
And then I'm like, well, is it really that big a deal? And then I got looking into it, and Booster has like 11 different events, reset events that it might run on, and for each of those events, for each loss monitor, there was a buffer for each of those events, and for each of those events there were three different kinds of buffers that got stored. There was the immediate buffer for that cycle, there was a 1 millisecond sum, there was a 100 second sum, there was a thing that fed the comfort display, and all of that was processed in the front end, and it was huge. And they could not pass the data across the VME backplane fast enough.
That's the problem. VME backplane is the problem.
Get it all done.
But we aren't even.
But it's. But I'm saying it's not just a slam dunk. It's a complex system like the BPMs actually, or it can be.
We're not ready, and we've been talking about going for PIP2 and we're going to do it. And but the thing is, there it will not be immediate. So the VME backplane is, if you use a standard VME backplane, yes, it's a bottleneck. So, for example, this VXS, we wanted to use a special serial backplane spec to make high-speed digital communication at the gigabit range, and that was the idea, but we're not going to do that. If you do it off the front, the fiber optics, when you go someplace, the individual boards are much higher bandwidth. So that's another reason not to use VME, is that everything we're using, of course, not as VME 64 and VME.
Oh, yeah, we definitely, machine requirements and the physics requirements are requesting and requiring more data than you can pass on a VME bus.
Yeah, I think at least, and maybe the BLM system would also, the BPM for sure, beam current, not so much. We don't have that many channels, not so much.
The BLMs, I noticed, there's a lot of channels of BLM.
There are a lot of BLM channels, right. So there's a lot, depending how we do the integration, that's the other thing is that we're gonna work on the spec here to come up with what kind of windows do we wanna have for the different BLM systems in terms of losses.
Either you do what Arden does with the different time constants, or you do what they did in the main injector with this new system, and you have
four different sums,
four different
integration links.
We're going to have something like that. Probably.
Four different sum links.
Different integration. But once you digitize and go into an FPGA, then and with the new cards with the memory buffering on there, the question is, what do we have? How much data do we have to get out in real time? So for MPS and for the real time system, what's the bandwidth there that we have to get out? And that's something I think we need to work on. It's a lot that we need to work on. So I better go finish more of my, like I finish this other thing and then get ready for my trip. I got so much enough to do. I delegated you for next week time card.
Okay.
So you should, if you don't see an email when you get back to your office, because it's never clear to me if I did it right or wrong after I do it. It doesn't really say you did it correctly, so hopefully you got an email or some message saying you've been delegated for next. I think I delegated you from Sunday to the whole week, like to Friday or something. Because I fly back on Friday, so I won't be here till the following Monday. Get to meet all this all the fun. Apparently next week all the parking is going to be screwed up too.
Will we be able to park behind A0 over here?
Yeah. I think so. I think that's not being touched.
But then, of course, if you don't get here early, all these other people have to flow back there too.
I know that there's. I don't know. They sent Tracy or somebody sent an email with the different. Apparently, it starts Monday. They start blocking stuff off.
I couldn't make sense of those diagrams.
I didn't either. They weren't readable. I didn't know what I think. Green usually means.
It's like
good.
What's a big red X mean?
That usually means. No.
Usually you think it means no.
Red means
but
something.
It seemed like the diagrams were supposed to show us where we could park.
They were so small. I figured, why does it matter? I'm not going to be here.
Let's see. I got a delegation request.
You got it? Okay, good. Yeah. So that'll be for the time. I filled my time card out already for this week.
So. Look, all right. You're good to go, man. Happy Friday.
I still got to work on this one, BOE.
Oh, gosh.
I'll be able to work on it next week when I'm gone. I don't mind going to these places, but I hate traveling anymore. It's going to be a long, long trip. All right. Well, here's how. I just got a mail from Vin Blocker from SNS. He won't be there. He's going to remote into it. I won't be able to talk to him next week, but I'll talk to the ESS people.
Well, email him if he has ESNH decisions. I talked to Paul Serapata. Paul Serapata spent the first 25 years of his career in interlocks. He was like the interlock guy, so he has all the engineering rules for interlocking things and machine protection type stuff. So I'm going to talk to Elvin and recommend that he...
Well, it isn't so much machine protection, it's also the philosophy is what does the accelerator want to do to protect itself? And I guess this needs
getting
Arcadia involved at some level, saying, okay, what do we want to do? Because it's more, like you said, it's kind of a philosophy.
You need the people that do the proper what-if analysis. I mean, the different failure modes.
Right.
You know, I mean, you could put something in that's great, but if you don't think through this chain of events, that could screw you up. Because usually that's what screws people up, is some weird chain of events.
Right, and those are always
power goes out here, so the MPS somehow that disables the MPS system because the power went out in some crate or rack.
Yeah. So that's what we're trying to.
Everything has to be fail safe.
I'll talk with the ESS people, at least get the names of the MPS guys, and because Elvin told me to maybe check with them and see. So, like I said, all day Thursday I'll have with them to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
All right, I better go finish more of the stuff so I can leave.
Well, thanks for coming.